and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us tonight on Infinite Consciousness. Tonight I have with us Dr. Raj Janeja, and we're going to talk about his book and his work with psychiatric problems and addiction, and his book, You Are More Than That. Hello, Dr. Raj, how are you?
Hi, Eva, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're so welcome. I'm so glad that you're here. Can you tell us a little bit about you and where we can find you before we get started?
Sure. So my website is www.thedrraj.com. And if anybody ever has any questions that they want to follow up with, they can also email me at thedrraj@gmail.com. But to give you a nutshell on myself, I'm a double board certified psychiatrist in adult psychiatry and in addiction medicine. I got very interested. I knew that it wasn't just about, you know, the biological. I knew it had to be more than just the biology. So I got very interested in consciousness and ultimately really attempting to answer the question, who am I? And on that journey, you know, I really studied a variety of things, neurosciences. I was in graduate school for neurosciences and integrative medicine, complementary alternative medicine. I did a fellowship with Andrew Weil that I just finished up last year. So really mind, body, spirit, you know, the biology, psychology, social, and spiritual. I mean, so really focus on those four aspects when I'm sitting with somebody to see really who is this person and how can I help them.
And how did you get started off the allopathic route into a mind-body route? What happened?
Well, I knew, you know, I knew that it wasn't necessarily just, you know, the answers that most people were attempting to, you know, answer for themselves. You know, it wasn't just in a prescription bottle. Now, let me say, as a medical doctor, I believe when appropriate, you know, you use the medical tools and, you know, and psychopharmacology has a place. Now, with that said, you know, do I think 35 million plus Americans need to be on antidepressants? No, I don't. Is it do we over-prescribe? Yes, I do think that happens because, you know, unfortunately today we are very much still in a disease management style of medicine in the United States instead of disease prevention. And the future, hands down, belongs in preventing the problem in the first place. So, you know, the biology did not answer all of my questions. And I got very interested in the mind. And, of course, you know, the brain and the mind are two different things. I can touch the brain, but I can't touch the mind. So, you know, that functional mind aspect and particularly got interested in not necessarily what was conscious and what was known, but actually what was unconscious, you know, the old analogy of the iceberg, you know, so what was above water was conscious mind. So we're having this conversation, Eva and Raj, et cetera, all conscious information. I can ask you, well, what'd you do, you know, for dinner last night? You can just go access that underneath the water. But then below that, just like the iceberg, a big 80, 90% of the mind is under the water. And this really became very evident to me graduation day. But let me give you a little more background as far as where I came from. So I was born in India, and I moved to the United States when I was 5 years old. And one of the things, you know, my father, who moved here with $13 in his pocket, you know, one of the things he said, you know, was literally in Hindi, but in English translation, become someone. And Eva, how I heard that was that I am an empty glass and somehow I have to fill this with something of value. And, you know, I went to graduate school in neurosciences, I studied neurosciences at Northwestern and then research. And I was, you know, bent. I was going to go to med school. I was going to become a doctor because I thought this was the way to finding my self-worth, or really not even finding, becoming self-worthy. At that point, I believed it lived outside of me. And make a long story short, I got in finally. I went through med school, graduation day, Lincoln Center, bright and sunny day. I remember that day like yesterday. And I was in my cap and gown, ready to walk in. And all of a sudden, I realized it hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't particularly feel any different. And I said, whoa, what's going on here? This was supposed to do it. This was supposed to be that me filling up the glass. And so I knew in that moment, there was an aha moment that, external reality and internal reality were two different things. And so I said, all right, I started my mission on figuring this out. I said, I have to figure out. I thought this was, going to, do a certain thing, and it didn't. There must be more going on in my mind than I realized. And ultimately, what I realized, and what I really ultimately talk about in the book is, well, I talk about many things we can get into, but one of the things I talk about is that self-worth is not something that comes and goes. When we're talking about even from a metaphysical point of view, everything at every point in space has equal worth, so to speak. Really, this is a human phenomenon, assigning value to something and saying that's good and that's bad, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the fundamental mistake mankind makes is the following. We believe, and we're conditioned to believe this when we're younger, this is how we're raised in the age of industrialization, that our external reality determines my internal self-worth. So if I have a bigger check, a bigger car, a bigger house, et cetera, that somehow is going to result in me being more worthy. But of course, that formula doesn't work. All these external, things, they have that, you feel, they fill your gas tank up for a little bit, but then it runs out. So it's not sustainable. And ultimately, what I'm associating to right now is I went to this lecture, and it was this Indian gentleman, and he started out, and he just looked at the crowd for about 10, 15 seconds, and he didn't say a word. And then I remember the opening line, and he said, the answer is right underneath your nose. And I think what he was saying is, the answer is you. You're already there. And so going back to what this fundamental mistake is, we are human beings. This is how I look at it. We are human beings. On the human side, yes, we have all of our problems, our challenges, our difficulties. It has nothing to do with the wholeness of the being that is also within us, that, that spiritual being, that part that is not broken. There's nothing missing. It is whole. It has always been whole from the moment of conception and even prior to conception, actually speaking metaphysically. And and as we know, energy can't be created or destroyed. It just transforms when we transition. And so this worthiness has always been there. So that's one of the main messages that I'm committed to really, getting out there is that, none of us are broken. None of us, have that hole that we have to fill. It's the perception that something is missing in our life. And it's usually from our conditioned beliefs from childhood.
A big smile came across my face. That makes so much, I'm so glad to hear a physician say that. So it makes me want to ask a question.
Yes, yes.
Tell me if I'm not understanding it right. Are you saying that we come in with whatever spiritual issues that we have of self-worth or self-esteem or whatever it is, we come in with it, and it's not someone else's fault necessarily, the people that are around us, our mother, our father. We come in because we have to learn something, is that right?
Well, I surely think we come in with, in Hinduism, of course, I'm sure you're familiar with this idea of karma and even dharma, our particular purpose to really find that enlightened place of really, I think that's one of the fundamental questions of why we're here is to discover who we are fundamentally. So there's this question of what do we bring in, energetically in those particles and literally in that moment of conception. Well, that's one thing. But I'm saying even in this human form, in this form that we are in this human being form, yes, I have problems, I have challenges, everybody does, but it doesn't mean that there's somehow something missing, spiritually, like in my wholeness, that I am still a whole being, even with my problems. Even that person who's, you know, homeless and laying, you know, sleeping on the sidewalk on Broadway in 76, he is a whole person. Yes, he has a lot of human circumstances that are troubling him, but, and, you know, it doesn't make him less worthy of a human being. So that's what I'm saying. In our worthiness, fundamentally, we are all worthy. Now, of course, many people say, well, what about evil? What about people that are evil, essentially? The way I see that is they are lost on the human side. They have no idea, no connection with the wholeness that exists within them. In fact, you know, I'm reminded of what one of my mentors, actually the late Eric Butterworth, would say. And he would say, you know, God can never come into your life. And people would look at him like shocked. Like, he said, he can never come in because he never left. You know, that we are fundamentally an expression of God consciousness at every point in space. This is everything around us, you and me and the air and everything else in this entire universe, is an expression of God consciousness.
So you treat psychological disorders and mood disorders, and you do that with this integrative approach. How successful
yes.
are you at doing that?
Well, I think I'm very successful at it. I believe that, you know, I've seen people literally, you know, I'll tell you what really, Eva, I think really fundamentally works is people knowing that somebody cares. You know, and that might sound, you know, really like it is straightforward, but having, I think, knowing, working with somebody that you know cares about you, genuinely wants to see you do good, and is going to work with you on the biological piece, so I go in with the biology, and when I say biology, yes, we're talking sometimes pharmaceuticals, and we're also talking nutraceuticals. Rhodiola is one of my favorite go-to herbs for anxiety, and it has lots of good evidence behind it now. St. John's wort works great for a mild to moderate depression, equivalent to, you know, 20 milligrams of Prozac. Recently, just on a side note, I read a study about saffron, you know, the spice saffron, mm-hmm. now has shown to have anti-anxiety and antidepressant properties. So we go in with that biological approach, nutraceutical, pharmaceutical, omega-3 fatty acids, you know, looking for the nutrient deficiencies, vitamin D, all of those aspects. Psychologically, so biologically, you know, we go in, and psychologically, I think hands down, we must understand our story. How did I get here? How, you know, who am I? That map, that, you know, I call it the life map. We have to build out that life map. What were those, you know, watershed moments of my life? Because one thing that fundamentally happens in our relationships is that anything that is unresolved from our childhood, and what I mean by that, conflicts that, and I'll give you a couple examples, but conflicts from our early childhood, then what happens is the mind unconsciously recreates these conflicts. And, you know, and of course one would think, well, why would it do that? It's so illogical. Well, here's the deal. The unconscious is illogical. Think about when you dream. You shut off your conscious mind, you know, you could fly, you could do all kinds of illogical things. Well, the unconscious mind is illogical, and it says, no, 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 even though this was 45 years ago, I still am going to hang on to this conflict. And I think what it does is it sets up a couple of things. One is it sets up an opportunity for it to get recreated and then healed, possibly, so that, you know, one can actually work through that unresolved conflict now. And secondly, you know, I think it has to do with procreation. Now, I don't have any evidence-based, you know, research behind that, but I think, you know, conflict leads to people, you know, getting together, separating, getting together, and of course, you know, reproduction, you know, happens. So I think part of it is very, you know, very amazingly designed within the system, I think, to make sure our species evolves. So biologically, psychologically, socially, we have to think about it. You know, when we're talking about addiction or addictive behaviors, you know, George Valiant out of Harvard, He did like a 40-year plus study, really quite amazing study, and he really followed these, you know, individuals who had alcoholism and other drug addictions. And one of the primary things that he found that worked in that whole 12-step model, which I think is a bit outdated in certain ways and needs to be updated, but one of the fundamental things that worked was the fellowship. People needed to belong, you know, to some new group, because usually people, you know, when they're using drugs and alcohol, sometimes it's alone, but oftenly, you know, it's in that new fellowship. And of course, some of these addictions really take over people's lives with them. You know, they start really drinking or, you know, drugging alone, or eating, or, you know, watching 10 hours of, you know, pornographic material, whatever their addiction might be. So biological, psychological, the social aspects have to be addressed, and then the spiritual piece. And the spiritual piece goes back to really what I was talking about at the beginning, which is we must understand that we have never been less than whole. We have always been really fundamentally, and I'm sure you would agree with this, we are light energy at its core. You know, how can that not be worthy, you know? It's all worthy, right?
I can't say anything any more than that. I mean, if there's no matter on the quantum level, then there's nothing else that we're God, in a sense. So I have a couple of questions. I'm going to tell you the questions. There's two of them that I want to talk about.
Okay.
And then you can answer however you want, okay?
Okay.
The first one is, when people get depressed with and start having addictions, there's usually some dopamine or some serotonin, some kind of neurotransmitter problem.
Yes.
Can they deal with that in a mind-body? Do those levels get restored? I mean, how does that happen? So I'll tell you the truth. I have a son that's an alcoholic.
Okay.
And this particular weekend, he happens to be missing in action somewhere out, you know, somewhere probably drinking. You know, nobody knows where he is, and that's probably what he's doing.
Okay.
So his girlfriend's like, what can I do, Mom? You know, what are some things that I can do to help him?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I have somebody that follows my show that's a doctor in Chicago, and he has a porn addiction, and he's been desperately seeking help for this for years. Is there something that can you help with that somehow?
Yeah, let's talk about that first question first.
Okay.
All right. So, dopamine is the neurotransmitter, and you know, just for the listeners, neurotransmitter. So it transmits information in the nervous system. Remember that we have a billion neurons or a billion brain cells, and each brain cell makes 10,000 connections with its neighbor. So it's a very, you know, complicated, you know, circuitry, so to speak. But the main neurotransmitter that's involved in addiction is dopamine, just like you said. Now, dopamine makes you feel pleasure. So, you know, that the cappuccino I was sipping on, my decaf cappuccino before we got on the phone, before we got on the show, that, you know, releases a little bit of dopamine. I said, that tastes good. That's a little bit of dopamine that got released. Sexual reproduction, why does it feel good? Because that's linked to dopamine. So anything that we had to really do as a species to survive, eat, reproduce, you know, got linked to dopamine. That state of feeling well, that's a little bit of dopamine being released at a steady state. The brain was never built to be flooded by dopamine. So what happens is essentially the person, you know, who is drinking, because that increases dopamine levels, marijuana, crack, cocaine, opiates, the painkillers, all of them, all work on the same system. And that's this pleasure-reward pathway linked with dopamine. Now, again, the brain was not meant to be flooded with dopamine. So, yeah, somebody takes, you know, let's say, snorts a line of methamphetamine, and dopamine goes from like where normally it's like levels of 100 or 150 units. We're talking it goes up to 1,100. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, my God, I have never felt like this before. Of course it's that. That's what makes it so addictive. Opiates not so different similarly. So what happens, the brain cannot control how much dopamine is being released. It can control where the dopamine goes and binds. So once the dopamine is released into that into that synaptic space between two brain cells, then basically the brain says, well, I'm being way overstimulated. I can't control the amount of dopamine. That's linked to how much drug or alcohol this person is using. But I can control the receptors. So take the receptors down. Down-regulate the receptors. And this is what we found over the last 10, 15 years. Actually, Nora Volkow over at National Institute of Mental Health, she really did some of the pioneering research in this and showed that basically what happens after, where drug and alcohol, it starts off as misuse and then goes to abusing that substance. But once you become dependent, that's when all these receptors have been down-regulated. And it doesn't matter how you get there. You can get there with heroin, you can get there with alcohol, you can get there with whatever substance. But once those receptors have been down-regulated, now think about this. This is how we feel pleasure normally. Now you get abstinent. And now once you're abstinent, your receptors are down-regulated. Going to the movies? Not really. Thanks, but no thanks. You want to go for a walk on the beach? Nah, not really. You just can't enjoy the simple things anymore. The scale's been thrown off. And really, this is what makes the first 30, 60, 90 days of abstinence very difficult, because people's receptors are downregulated and they don't really feel a whole lot of pleasure, and they got a whole laundry list of problems that have happened because of the addiction itself while it was happening. But here's the bottom line. It's not too late. Because this is a lot of times people with addictions think, they'll label themselves, I'm just an addict, I'm this, I'm that, it's too late. And I say, no, you are more than that. And that's where the title of my book really came from, is all of these self-limiting thoughts. I've sat with thousands of people at this point, and in their story, there was so many places where, they started believing all the I can'ts. And no, I'm not smart enough, and I'm not this enough. And of course, that's where the rate limitation lives. But what happens is now the person's abstinent, and they start believing in themselves, and they start getting through the 30 days and the 60 days. And around 90 days, the receptors, the brain says, whoa, 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 where'd all that dopamine go? Because the dopamine levels obviously have dropped off, because now the person's abstinent. Now we'll start putting the receptors back up. And so that process can take a good year to 2 years. So this is why it's not an easy addiction. It's a very complicated disease. Now, we also have to be careful, and I call it a disease as a physician, but I have to be careful, and I tell people this. Listen, now, just because you have this disease doesn't mean that you can take the back door and say, well, I got this disease, and that's why I got high the other night. No, no, no. If you had diabetes, you'd have to manage that properly. If you had high blood pressure, and malignant hypertension, your blood pressure is 220 over 110, and it can kill you, boy, you better manage it, and you better manage it good. Otherwise, you may not make it. So I use all of these, biology, psychology, social, spiritual pieces when I'm thinking and about, how to best approach somebody. And, some people want to come in more on the bio, side, some people more on the spiritual. And so the goal is get people into treatment, because treatment works, hands down. For the most part, whoever they go to, of course, sometimes you do have people that, are not so, that might not be actually good at treatment. But my point is, treatment works, getting into, even just going to meetings, just that feeling of I'm not alone, being in a fellowship, that's the main approach in. And so going back to the dopamine, it can be corrected, but it takes time. It takes a significant amount of time, and that's what makes it very challenging. Just a last comment on that. The research clearly shows that people who make it to day 90 have a higher chance of long-term abstinence and sobriety than people who don't. And remember that abstinence does not equal sobriety. Abstinence plus recovery. You got to do that recovery work. And, how did I get here? What's my story? What am I self-medicating? Because a lot of times, somebody may have a very strong history of depression in their family, for example, that needs to get, we need to aggressively treat it. And sometimes, it's more psychological, sometimes biological. But, today we treat it either way. The question is, how are we going to treat it? And, you know, again, psychotherapy, I think, is a key element. You know, we can use the biological, pharmaceutical, nutraceutical, and things like acupuncture, you know, energy medicine. I know you're a big fan of, you know, of energy medicine as well. And, you know, thinking about those elements. There's some really cool, there's this device out where actually you put it on your earlobes, and what it does is it actually changes out all the electrons in your brain. You know, like it basically, because you have you have this handheld device, it's called AlphaStem, A-L-P-H-A, AlphaStem. I have no connection with them financially, so you know, but it's an interesting device. Somebody wants, and they've done research on this. And in fact, the government is using it. The research shows in PTSD it helps.
Is it a frequency or is it a microcurrent?
It's a microcurrent. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's a microcurrent.
That's what I thought. No, I have one of those things. Well, I don't want to get off topic because this is important to me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. But I'm saying that we need to use a multidisciplinary approach. We cannot use a cookie cutter, one size fits all. We really need to understand, you know, who this person is sitting across from me. And but that one, if there's one part though that I think is ubiquitous and important to look at and universally look at, is we have to go through that story because that's where the rate limitations live. And really, right now, I'm developing a whole. Really, a virtual platform to help people. It's not up. It's not up yet. It's being built, but to help people really, you know, really, if they go through the steps of this platform, what they'll end up with at the end is their story, at least the highlights of that story, and to help them understand really and start thinking about where did I come from? You know, how did those earlier events of my life impact me? What are my repetitive self-sabotage patterns? And let me just say one more thing, which is it's not about saying, you know, blaming parents or blaming our caretakers. And, you know, it's not about that at all. What it's about is understanding what happened. Oh, that happened. Let me give you a couple examples. So I was treating a couple in New York, and the wife, basically, her father had unfortunately passed away at an early age. So, you know, she always wanted somebody who was going to be present, you know, a male present, so to speak. Now, who does she end up picking to marry? Now, of course, this was all unconscious. But who she ends up picking to marry is a Wall Street gentleman who works about 100 hours a week. Is he home a lot? The answer is, of course, no. So she recreates this piece, even though consciously she says, well, you know, I definitely want somebody who is going to be around. And then she picks a guy who works 100 hours a week. Him, if you look at his background, he grew up in a very critical house. And, you know, he always wanted to be accepted. You know, can you just accept me for who I am? But there was a lot of, you know, criticism in the house. Now, but he chose somebody. Again, he didn't choose somebody who was going to be maybe on the quieter side or non-critical side. He chose somebody who could be very critical, who can really get the knife out, so to speak, symbolically, of course, metaphorically, and really start, you know, getting critical with him. So when they first came in, they were ready to separate, you know, because they obviously they didn't see all of this underneath the water stuff that was happening. They both had effectively recreated, you know, these earlier core conflicts. And then that's when the work begins. Because what has to happen as far as in that kind of situation is both individuals on both sides have to become aware of the other's unmet needs. You know, so you have to become aware of your partner's unmet needs and be able to appreciate where they come from. Why is this person so sensitive? Ah, well, they're so sensitive because X, Y, and Z in a particular area. Okay, now, yes, I love this person, so now I'm going to make more of an effort to be supportive in that particular area. But this is the kind of, you know, in-depth work it takes. So just that's just an example of, you know, the unconscious mind and the power of it. Because, you know, really, there's so much suffering going on in relationships nowadays. You know, we have tremendous separation and divorce rates. And then you think about, well, even the people who get to stay together, how many of them are really, truly, you know, in joy and happiness? Really, probably, you know, a small percentage. So I really, my purpose really became then, a number of years ago, was to create an arena really to help people become more self-aware, you know, more socially aware. Of course, my mind is going to emotional intelligence, but become more emotionally intelligent and become more intelligent about how the mind works and to be able to make better decisions.
Well, we're 30 minutes into the show, so
okay.
I want you to talk about that emotional intelligence right now, but remember we have that pending addiction thing, that porn addiction thing. But when, since you brought it up, what is emotional intelligence, and what can somebody do to find that?
All right. So basically, I mean, there's a lot of information on emotional intelligence, and Daniel Goleman, he was a New York Times science writer, PhD, PhD psychologist, and he really popularized it. But this idea, you know, well, let me actually back up. So IQ, the intelligent quotient, well, that, you know, is a fixed number, and that cannot be changed. But what we found was that emotional intelligence, EI, could be shifted. You could become literally more emotionally intelligent. So what do I mean by emotional intelligence? So what I mean by that is self-awareness, and I'll get into what I mean by each of these. Self-awareness, you know, social awareness, so how the other person is doing, right? And how am I doing, and how is the other person doing? Self-awareness, social awareness, relationship management, fundamentally teaching people how to, you know, manage their emotions, be aware of the other emotions, and get, you know, a result that was really a win-win result for both individuals. So let me give you an example of each area there. So for self-awareness, you know, knowing what your strengths and weaknesses are, knowing how you're feeling. If you're feeling walking into a meeting and if you're a little bit in an irritable mood, knowing you're in an irritable mood is a value, you know, versus just being reactive and making reactive, impulsive comments because you're irritable. So there's a value to know where you're at. There's also a value to know where the other person is at, right? So say, for example, if somebody walks into my office and they slam the door, right? Now, I can either react to that and take it personally, this person slamming the door and this is directed at me and they don't respect me and all this, right? I can go kind of down that line, that road, or I can say, I wonder why John is upset. He just slammed the door, you know, and just say, okay, so he seems a little bit, obviously something's going on today. So now he sits down. I'm in a very different mindset versus the first situation I described, right? And now we're talking self-awareness, social awareness, relationship management. And I think the fundamental principle that people have to really, you know, become aware of is how do they react to the environment? You know, I mean, just in a everyday example, road rage. You know, people are very reactive, right? But think about when somebody, you know, floors the gas pedal, catches up with somebody or cuts somebody off purposely, they're really such a high-risk behavior. They can end up really dead. It could be fatal to get in a bad accident on the highway. So it pays a lot not to react, but you do want to respond. So I always tell people, listen, we don't want to take the reactive position. We want the responsive position. And so it's just like, actually, think about an ER physician. Or I used to tell people on the inpatient unit, this is actually where I fundamentally started putting this stuff together. I was a unit chief on a dual diagnosis unit, and you know, I would see people really having meltdowns. And it was a locked door unit, so you know, it's a little bit of a pressure cooker system there, I get it. But you know, people melting down because they didn't get orange juice and they got milk instead, or you know, these really, you know, these kinds of situations. And I'd go into the room and I'd say, you know, John, you know, I saw you, you know, react, you know, and we talk about it a little bit. And I would say, listen, I go, you know, you see me running around, you know, I'm seeing patients, pagers going off, you know, and phone calls and nursing. I go, can you imagine if I was really reactive? I go, how well do you think I'd be able to do my job? And they get that. They say, oh, no, not at all. It wouldn't work. And I'd say, you know, I wasn't born with this skill. I learned it. I said, you can learn it too. So then when I would write on their hospital band, I would get a black Sharpie pen and I would write the question, am I in reaction? Question mark. And I would say, I want you to think about this question. And as you're, you know, here the next few days, however many days with us, keep this question in mind. And I guarantee you that if you can get a handle on your reactive behavior, your life will change, period. And so usually what happens is people will initially, you know, catch themselves after they're already in reaction. So I always tell people that's the place you start. You know, you say, oh, I'm really upset. Ask that question. Am I in reaction? Oh, yeah, I am in reaction. Okay. Of course, naturally, the next question is, well, what happened? Oh, well, you know, right before I left work. Yeah, I was okay, right? You know, I was getting ready, and I felt okay, but then I got in the car, and I was really upset. Well, somewhere along the getting ready and getting into the car, something got triggered. And immediately, now you're doing, you know, your work and understanding, pausing, examining, so you can understand what happened, instead of reactively saying, you know, whatever you might say as you're walking out the door and starting out the door in such a negative vibration. So that's really what emotional intelligence is about. It's about becoming aware of really your own emotions, so understanding emotions, using emotions, and managing emotions. And a lot of that comes down to the perception. And that's what I mean by we have to be able to take a step back and not react to it, but respond to that. And actually, you know, if anybody's interested, you know, they can email me at thedrraj@gmail.com, and you know, because I do emotional intelligence, consultations, and because I think, again, these are such key things to be able to think about. In fact, I'll tell you, most of your top CEOs and all, they all do these EI, you know, trainings, all these emotional competencies. This is big in, you know, the Fortune 300 companies, because they right away got it that, you know what, you can have somebody from your, you know, top 10 business school, but if they're not very emotionally intelligent, those leaders don't last. And in fact, a lot of them end up losing their job. So what really made the difference wasn't just how smart somebody was IQ-wise, but also how smart they were EI, or emotional intelligence-wise. So that's just the nutshell on emotional intelligence. And again, you know, you can find some information on my website, thedrraj.com. Also, Wikipedia, has, I heard recently that actually now it's more accurate than the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is amazing.
Wow.
People used to be a little bit critical about it, but in general, it's a decent place for some starter information. It's obviously not the end all be all, but you know, there's a lot of information on the internet now, for that. So did that answer that question okay?
I think so.
Okay.
it's a lot of information, but it's great. So does it have any, and I don't want to go off on this, but I just want to know in the response, does it connect with what HeartMath is doing?
With HeartMath, I'm not familiar what they are doing. Actually, maybe you could tell me about that.
It's about heart cohesion, but I can send you some information. It just sounds like they talk about heart intelligence, so I thought maybe it was connected to that somehow. Anyway, so now you've brought up another question before we move to the porn addiction thing.
Yes.
Somebody came to me the other day that's bipolar.
Yes.
And they have these things where they do this ranting and raging, and then they go deep into this crying depression.
Uh-huh.
And so they got a neurotransmitter test, and when it came back, one of the things that surprised me is that their taurine levels were off the chart. I mean, it went to as far as the graph would go on taurine. Why would that be? What does that mean?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, taurine is an amino acid, right? And it is used in the synthesis of neurotransmitters. And so that's immediately what my initial, thought goes to, that it's an organic acid, and it's used in a variety of different metabolic processes. Now, of course, again, it is used as an amino acid. You know, amino acids are involved in, making proteins and have a variety of, let me back up, neurotransmitters are then made up of these proteins. So, so taurine then plays a role in neurotransmission in the brain. It actually crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is interesting, and it's been implicated in a wide array of different physiological phenomena. And really, it has inhibitory properties in neurotransmission. So when we say, when we're talking about neurotransmitters, you can think of them either they're excitatory, they're going to excite that brain cell, or inhibitory, and they're going to make it more difficult for that brain cell to become excited. And so, there's such a fine balance of all of these neurotransmitters. Again, think a billion neurons making, 10,000 connections, each one with the next neighbor. So so it surely plays a role in neurotransmission. Now, let me back up and say a few comments about bipolar disorder, and then let's see if there's any thoughts that bring these things together. What is bipolar disorder? I want you to fundamentally, the way to think about this is it's two ends of a pole. On the bottom end, you have depression. And when I say depression, I'm not talking about just I feel a little down today. I'm talking about a major depressive episode, somebody who really is not getting out of bed. Their appetite has changed. Their concentration and focus has changed. They may be suicidal. Really depressed. On the other end, you have, so depression on the one end of the pole. On the other end, you have the mania, what we call mania. This is almost, a good way to think of this is, having the DVR setting on fast forward. And the person is just moving really two or three, four times the speed everybody else is. And it's because their brain, the thoughts are coming. Some individuals will say, the thoughts come faster than I can even keep up with them. And a lot of times, initially, people like that charged manic state because all of a sudden they, 2 hours of sleep and they're good to go. They're like, wow, I'm being so productive. I have all these thoughts. All these creative ideas start coming to them. They get impulsive as well. They can become hypersexual. They can, so you start making bad decisions because you're moving way too fast, right? You can get grandiosity. I remember I had this young man in the hospital, and he told me, he was in his 20s, and he said, listen, by 30, I'm going to be the governor of this state, and by 35, I'm going to be the president of the United States. Now, of course, this was on a psychiatric unit, Now, again, is it impossible? It's not impossible. But what I'm saying is, he was clearly being grandiose, in that moment. So bipolar disorder. Now, that is a good way to look at it. Now, clearly, of course, there are neurotransmitters involved. Now, if taurine, I'm just thinking out loud here with you, if taurine is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, then I would think if taurine levels are very high, then I would think that there would be more inhibition going on in the brain, and therefore the brain should be quieter. And I wonder, was that individual that you're talking about, were they more on the depressed, irritable side?
When they took the test, no, he was raging.
And
was what I was wondering, does methylation have anything to do with that?
I would tell you, and I'm not a biochemist, and so I surely, don't know the in-depth methylation, the steps of, taurine getting, basically getting produced into neurotransmitters and where they get methylated and so on and so forth. But I would, again, honestly, I'll tell you, Eva, it is such a complicated, I think to say that it's one thing or it means one thing would relatively not do it justice. And I really think, that would a biochemist would be really much more apt to answer that. So I guess really what I'm saying is I'm not sure.
It just kind of surprised me. I had never seen anybody with not that I've I'm not a doctor, but,
yeah.
You know, speaking of that, I just want to tell everybody, even though Dr. Raj is a medical doctor, we're not attempting to diagnose or treat anyone on this show. We're just giving information to help you make intelligent decisions about your life.
That's it. You should always speak to somebody professionally, you know, before you use any piece of advice, you know.
I just was surprised to see taurine like that way up so high on someone that doesn't supplement taurine.
Yeah, I look into that, Eva, and I'll follow up with you and your listeners on that.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it?
It's an interesting thing
to be maxed out. You know, you expect norepinephrine or epinephrine or something, but taurine, it's just weird.
Yeah, taurine.
Anyway.
And, you know, this is actually one of the exciting pieces about neurosciences and really one of the reasons I wanted to go into it, which was, you know, there's a lot we don't know, really, quite honestly. And this is actually the excitement. There's some excitement in that we can really, we're still uncovering and we can think about, we can think outside the box. And I know you love to, you know, really be creative in that sense and think about what are the possibilities. Because in going back to taurine for a second, you know, let me just, as I'm thinking, you know, glutamate is also another neurotransmitter, and it's very excitatory. And when you have too much glutamate excitation, it can actually be toxic. And so there's always this balance between, you know, again, excitation and inhibition. So taurine, if it's involved in inhibition, I'm wondering in that individual, if they were very overly excited, and then as a response, the brain cranked up, you know, the levels of taurine.
Maybe
so. Right?
That's
so it was
good
really
point
just trying to.
Because we had that. I had this man get this test and hold on to it until the next time when he raged, because we were just trying to figure. I mean, we had people all over the country looking at this case because it was just quite unique, the behavior there. And so we all decided, okay, let's wait till he does it again and test him. So he hung onto the kit, raged the next time, and took the test. I bet that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, because, you know, think of it, so glutamate levels were, you know, out of control, ceiling high, and then the body and the brain may have started really using this as a way to inhibit, you know, that excitation response. That's probably the best
that makes a lot of sense.
Hypothesis.
Never even thought about that. You're so smart. All right, we got 10 minutes. What do you want to talk about?
Starting with 15 minutes. Well, you know, I know you love talking about consciousness, and I love talking about consciousness, you know, in the Higgs boson, and I was so excited, and, you know, when July 4th last year, I saw it on the cover of the New York Times that they had thought to, you know, have identified it, and now they seem to have confirmed that, you know, fundamentally that really we are all, you know, these made up of elements, and now these elements are made up of atoms, and these atoms are made up of these fundamental particles. Now that they're calling Higgs boson, and I just think that's so cool, and that's just because, you know, actually here's something to think and talk about. Well, then I started thinking about, well, what are if we're fundamentally made up of these particles, and these particles actually attract mass. Now, again, this is all just me thinking. I haven't done any fancy experiments on this. I just want to say that up front. But if we are fundamentally made up of these particles and these particles attract mass, then that means, okay, well, then what are my brain cells? Well, my brain cells then are fundamentally these particles that are attracting the mass and they're giving rise to my brain and my brain tissue. And then I said, well, what does the brain do? It generates these electrical, you know, responses, right? It's all this electrical transmission going on, and it creates an electromagnetic field. And then I started thinking, oh, my God, I said, could this be the way that our thoughts actually attract reality and change reality as it comes and goes, you know, what? And, you know, just this whole idea of not just what we consciously think, and this is what I think fundamentally people may or may not understand. You know, because you remember there was that book, I think it was The Secret, and it was about, you know, if you hold this thought in consciousness, you can, you know, that the universe will create it or help you. Well, yes and no. If you consciously, you may believe I am worthy and I am, you know, whole. But if unconsciously or subconsciously, you know, below the water, you believe you are not, that is much more the powerful belief that is in control. So what do you think of that? I'm saying
I can't. Remember when I talked to you earlier and I said, be sure and send me your email?
Yes.
I found this new technology. I
yes.
can't wait for you to see it.
Because it has right along those lines, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just really, really amazing. And it's called the Portacle. Let's see if I can. There are two parts to this, and the Portacle doesn't actually come out until September, if I'm not mistaken. Hold on, I'm going to just try to go there quickly. There's two sites. I'm going to give them both to you.
Okay.
One of them is called www.harmonicresolution.com.
Harmonicresolution.com.
Yes. And this guy, Don Estes, he's the one that did this. He and another physicist, and I can't think of his name. He's an Indian guy.
Okay.
And the one that I told you, Harvard just published his paper. And then
yeah.
there's VibraSound. It's VibraSound.com.
Got it.
And then there's the Portacle site. And I'm going to have to go there because it's not.
What is it? P-O-R?
It's called the Portacle. I think this is. Let me just make sure before I give it out in the air.
No problem.
It's called the Portacle, PORTACLE.com, the ultimate journey to conscious evolution. And you don't get to use the program on here unless you purchase it.
I gotcha.
Just the science. But I have the program, and I have to tell you, it is probably the single most amazing thing relative to consciousness that I've ever seen.
It's
amazing.
Yeah, because I think
it's like
really
Star Trek technology.
I love it.
It's really, really amazing. It's kind of way over my head. I'm really having to fool with it. It's complicated. It is. I have to admit that it is complicated. But once you get this program, you download it on your computer, and you have to wear headsets and a mic, and it takes your breath and your voice, and it uses your intention and amplifies your intention out to the universe, and it gives you like a measurement on how in sync or cohesive you are with the various aspects of creativity. The first one's like living in physical reality, so you're not really in touch with your creative consciousness, you know, because you're living and going to work and driving, and you're not being in that altered state of mind.
Uh-huh.
Then you have the part where you think about it, and I can't remember the words that he uses exactly, but then you have the part of where you think about it, and then you have the other part where you actually start intending it. Then there's mm-hmm. another part where you actually manifest, and he actually has frequencies with sound, like E flat or B flat, and it tells you exactly where you are, because we know that sound and frequency is everything that is.
Of course.
You know, it's just really an amazing thing. I can't even explain it all. I'm going to interview him. Let me see when I'm doing this.
And so this is the exciting. This is the future. This is the future to really start thinking about what is it that we don't know, and to start thinking about mind, body, spirit, to start thinking about metaphysics. And really, and this isn't, you know, so much foo-foo. This is, we're talking science here. You know, this is real science, people doing real research. And again, you know, I remember, or I'm reminded about, you know, even when they found that the Earth was not flat, you know, and it was round, it was about 3 or 4 decades before people believed this, you know. And so, you know, listen, I'm a scientist, you know, at heart, and I like to have proof before I start, you know, talking about things. And this is the exciting part. And I think it's good to say, listen, this is what we don't know, and this is what we do know, and this is what I think might be possibly happening. And start thinking about it, opening up our minds and thinking about, you know, one of my, good acquaintances would say, new realities, you know, Alan Steinfeld, and he talks a lot about new realities. But what are the pieces that we, you know, just have been conditioned to think that's not possible? That's impossible. But really, we're just wrong. We just don't know.
So tell us where, one more time, the name of your books and where we can find you.
Absolutely. It's okay. So the name of my book is You Are More Than That, and it's Rajiv Juneja, R-A-J-I-V-J-U-N-E-J-A. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's actually published by Hay House Publishing, and you can go to the hayhouse.com website. I also do have a weekly radio show on hayhouseradio.com every Thursday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, live, and they can join me there, as well as thedrraj.com. That's the website, and then thedrraj@gmail.com. If anybody has any questions, please email me. I'll happily, happily do my best to get them.
And it's Dr. Raj, D-R-R-H-J, not spelled out, right?
That's correct. It's actually the Dr. Raj, because there's a lot of Dr. Rajs out there. So it's thedrraj.com.
Okay.
Dr.
You have
Raj.
1 minute. If you could say anything you wanted to the world, what is it?
I would say that fundamentally we are all whole. We are all complete. Nobody is broken. Even though you fundamentally, yes, you have problems. Yes, we have faults. Yes, we have challenges. Yes, we've made mistakes. But it does not mean you are not worthy. You were worthy the moment you came into this, into this existence, and you're going to be just equally as worthy when you transition. This is not a fluctuating thing that comes and goes. You are more than that.
Thank you, Dr. Raj, for taking the time to come on my show. You're a blessing.
I love
it.
Thank you. Of course, thank you, my dear. Thank you so much. God bless.
Have a good evening. Take care and come back.